I'm going to talk a little bit about some pretty big concepts that I think many of you already know intuitively in your own experience, but that you might not have thought about in terms of how they impact your work and your planning for the future. And really, that's what I'm talking about here today. I'm talking about the future. There's a wonderful quote from science fiction writer William Gibson. He said, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet. Now, I read that and I went, wow, that is exactly my experience. That's what I have spent sort of my life pursuing. And it led me to think a little bit about kind of a theory of technology evolution, if you like. And the way I think about, just from watching people like you, is that the way most technologies develop is through a sequence in which hackers start out by pushing the envelope in a variety of ways. I'll walk through some examples in a minute. But after that, you have entrepreneurs who come along and they make things easier for ordinary users. And then you have dominant players kind of emerge out of the scrum, and they start to integrate things into a platform. Now, at that point, one of two things can happen. That dominant player can raise barriers to entry. And there's a story here that my mother likes to take. Some point in my past career, when I was in some particular dust-up with Microsoft, I was telling the story to my mother, and she said, you know, she's a little old English lady, and she says, you know, he sounds like somebody who'd come over to your house for dinner and say, you know, I think I'll have all the mashed potatoes. And, you know, this is obviously not good social behavior. The other option is that we figure out how to build a healthy ecosystem where a lot of companies can cooperate. But whatever happens, things start to get boring and the hackers and the entrepreneurs both move on looking for new frontiers. So let me give you an example of this from the history of the personal computer, which many of you know about. The early personal computers were developed really by hackers. In fact, some of you may know the very first Apple was made of wood. Steve Wozniak actually kind of put together this, you know, box, and he put some components in it, and he made his own, you know, home computer. And before long, these early hackers who were, you know, dusting it up with this incredible new technology started saying, wow, we could make money at this. And they started trying to make it easier for other people. And we had this big explosion of effectively personal computer companies, most of whose names are forgotten. I put a list there of people that I remembered from my first introduction to the personal computer. And obviously, Apple's still around. Compaq just went away. Osborne, Columbia, and K-Pro are long gone. The other thing that happened was kind of interesting, was that this new platform also led to opportunities for software entrepreneurs, which was a pretty new thing. And so you had companies like Software Arts, Lotus, and Microsoft kind of came out. And of course, we know how all that played out. Over time, we did in fact see the emergence of a platform, some dominant players, and Microsoft and Wintel, not quite, but almost took over the world. And sure enough, things became boring. And meanwhile, Windows was getting more and more uninteresting. And, people were saying, where's the next big thing come from? And, of course, it came from completely out of left field, at least relative to the personal computer revolution. And that was the Internet, which had been kind of growing up in the research and university community and on the Unix platform. And it came out of nowhere relative to the PC, so it was a new platform. So looking at that history, there's some tools to think with. And I want to lay the groundwork here because we have to think about what these past lessons will tell us for the future. So I want to bring up a couple of books. The first one is one I read in college. Maybe some of you read it too. It's called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's a book that introduced the concept of the paradigm shift. Now, of course, paradigm shift is a term that became so ill-used that at one point you could kind of be like the knights that say knee in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where you could say paradigm shift and people would cringe back, because it was sort of this magic incantation that, you know, was just so horrible. But the fact is, the concept of a paradigm shift is that often in when you have a truly revolutionary technology or scientific innovation, it requires a change of worldview. And in the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Kuhn pointed out this idea that the switch from Ptolemaic to Copernican astronomy was more than just sort of a set of discoveries. It was a change in the way you had to think about everything. You know, you had to think, oh my God, if the Earth isn't the center of the universe, well, what does that mean about our place in the universe? And you know, some of those you know, those thought changes have been you know, working their way out for hundreds of years thereafter. So there's another book that I recommend. This one that came out about 5 years ago called The Innovator's Dilemma. Now, you go, well, what does this have to do with paradigm shifts and scientific revolutions? It has another wonderful concept in it, and that's the concept of disruptive technologies. Clayton Christensen's thesis is that many, there's really two types of new technologies. The first are what he calls sustaining technologies, just incremental improvements to existing technologies. But there are also technologies that are profoundly disruptive. And his point is that disruptive technologies often don't work as well as the technologies they replace. But they get better faster than the old technologies, and eventually they take over. And I put these two concepts together because the disruptive technologies often have within them the seeds of a paradigm shift. So if you think about the PC, when it first came out, it was derided as a toy. You know, all the mainframe computer vendors said, oh, it's just, you know, it doesn't work, you know, it's just, don't take it too seriously. And, you know, people like Ken Olson of Digital said, I don't know why anybody would want one. But eventually, of course, PCs got bigger and they got better faster than Big Iron and eventually took over the world. Similarly, I think we're right now in one of those kinds of disruptive technology paradigm shifts with respect to open source software. It's changing the nature of the business in some fairly profound ways, and we're all, as an industry, struggling to understand those changes. And my premise is that if you don't understand the profound changes that can come from disruptive technologies, and if you don't make the paradigm shift, you're actually, I guess I can say this in this group, you know, you're fucked. You know, it's just, you know, and we see this history again and again. And so I want to give you a couple of examples of this sort of paradigm shift idea and what failing to understand it meant. So in that PC era paradigm shift, there were a couple of implications that were fairly profound. And one was that hardware was becoming commoditized. You know, the personal computer at its heart was built out of commodity components. Yes, there are some proprietary components in there, the Intel processors, for example. But an awful lot of the pieces were things that you could put together. And you could buy it all off the shelf. So people could start off like Michael Dell did in a dorm room, you know, assembling and selling PCs. You know, in the old days, you know, the secret of success in the computer industry was to have, you know, better proprietary hardware. And, you know, I was really, this was, came across very vividly in a book I read, some of you may also have read, called The Soul of a New Machine. It came out in, I believe, in the 80s. It was about the development of a new computer at Data General. You know, it was all about how they had to, you know, they had to invent their own boards and they had to come up with all this stuff. They had to write their own operating system. And here's this commodity era that starts to come around where, you know, these companies didn't have to do that anymore. But at first, people like Compaq and all the other people who were in the personal computer industry didn't realize that. They kept trying to make some little bit of proprietary advantage. You know, they would sit there and they'd say, oh great, you know, we'll introduce a new bus and that'll be why people will buy our machine. And there's a point in Michael Dell's book where he talks about realizing they actually had been trying to play that game and they were trying to innovate with some new piece of hardware that was going to be better or different or whatever. And he realized that, no, and the project failed. And it was at that point that he realized that the real secret for them was to think about this new business model in the form of logistics and, you know, supply chain management and the like. And so they really started to embrace this new model, think about its consequences. And so that's why Dell is now the largest personal computer maker. Another story of consequences is the story of Microsoft versus IBM. IBM knew what computers were. They were hardware, right? And that was what really mattered. And we own this business. We're the biggest company in the world. So they made a deal with Bill Gates in which they said, okay, tell you what, we will get an exclusive license for this software on our hardware, and you can take the rest of the world, right? And they didn't realize that, with this commodity hardware, everybody would be making PCs, not just them, and that the rest of the world was actually going to be bigger than them, right? So they effectively gave away that future in that deal because they failed to think about the consequences. And so that's really what my talk today here is about. In a lot of ways, it's thinking about consequences. And there was a wonderful quote from Ray Kurzweil, who many of you know is an inventor, really now pretty seriously into AI and some fairly far out stuff. But I heard him talk earlier this year, and he made a wonderful point. He said, I started thinking about long-term trends because I'm an inventor. And an invention has to make sense in the world where you finish building the invention, not the one where you start building it. That's a wonderful thought to kind of put in your pocket, take out every once in a while and read it and think about it and start thinking about what are the long-term trends that we're facing now and how are they going to change our world. So coming back to this theme of watching the alpha geeks, a lot of what I feel like I do in my business is I find cool people. And I say, well, what are they doing? What are they interested in? Because those people often will tell you before anybody else about those long-term trends. Yeah, you can be a pundit and you can speculate all you like, but the first sign of the future is often people like you. People who are able to use the technology a little bit outside the box. You can push the envelope. So you look at what hackers are typically doing, and you can say, well, 5 years from now, ordinary people will be doing that. So for us, we started using the internet, many of us, well before there were hundreds of millions of people in the U.S. doing it. And so, at O'Reilly, we have kind of a reputation of being prescient, about technology. We just watch what the early adopters are doing, and then we sort of say, okay, it's ready to spread to the next layer out. But right now, I've been looking a lot at what hackers are doing and what they tell us about the shape of the future. I've got a couple of points. Now, one of the things is obviously to assume network connectivity. You guys know that. We also have to assume cheap local storage. Storage is getting extremely cheap. Coming up here for a reason or just keep me company? I see he's got the hook for when I'm supposed to get off. So he definitely has the hook. I mean, I even see it there. We all sort of got the internet. The internet is the next big thing. But just like IBM didn't get the implications of the PC, I'm not sure that any of us have completely understood the implications of the internet. And as one person said, actually I believe this was a Microsoft engineer, he said, we have a lot more internet time ahead of us than behind us. And some of the changes that I see happening are driven by people understanding things just a little bit differently. Not long before Napster came out, I was down at mp3.com. Now, mp3.com is a pretty cool place. They were showing off their 4,000, Linux rack mounted servers and, telling me how, God, we've got, how many terabytes worth of songs and wasn't this so cool? And I like these guys. They're, Linux, MySQL, Perl. That's great. And then along came this college kid who grew up in the age of the internet, and he didn't think he needed to have all the songs in one place. He grew up in the age of the internet, and he knew that other people were connected, and they already had the songs. So he thought a little bit differently about it. And he said, okay, all I have to do is point to the songs. So here was mp3.com, a pretty cool company, but still rooted in this client-server model where you put stuff in one place, as opposed to sort of thinking more about what's it look like once everybody is connected, all the time. And that's what I'm referring to as a paradigm shift. So obviously, we know that wireless is ubiquitous. I don't know how many of you guys, how many people here in the audience are sitting here with a laptop? So it looks like you know, 70% of you. But it was kind of interesting. I've been watching for 4 or 5 years as hackers have been building out wireless community networks. I think the first person I heard talk about this was Kevin Lenzo, who some of you may know. He's a guy who does open source speech synthesis, but it must have been 5 years ago. He was saying, oh, I just set up some antennas in South Pittsburgh so I could, you know, use my laptop in the local coffee shop. You know, and I went, oh, interesting. And then, you know, you hear a couple more people doing it. And then, you know, a year or two ago, you know, we started having people building antennas out of Pringles cans to, you know, extend the range of 802.11. And actually, there's a great story about, it was actually a guy who works for me who did the Pringles can thing. And he wrote an article about it. And then some guy in Egypt had a project to kind of use the Pringles cans to go across the Red Sea. And he, unfortunately, he made the mistake of eating all the Pringles. And it set his project back 2 days, he said. But in fact, then there was this great homebrew antenna shootout. I don't know if you guys ever heard about this, but people were trying all kinds of different cans, you know, Dinty Moore's chunky beef stew versus, you know, Hunt's tomato sauce. And, you know, building these, you know, homemade antennas that were extending the range. You know, that's what I mean by the hackers pushing the envelope. You know, okay, here's the thing, it goes, you know, with a tie book on a good day, it's, you know, it seems like it's 20 feet if you're lucky. Other times you do pretty well. But sure enough, the hackers were playing around with it. But now, you know what, a year or two later, we're starting to get better antennas. We're having startups who are saying, wow, we're going to extend this range. We have Boingo and T-Mobile saying we're going to build out these networks. Well, the hackers were doing it first. But it's pretty clear to me that this is eventually going to be ubiquitous. It's going to be everywhere. It's going to be everything. Now, I know you guys aren't quite as far along as the pure Mac OS X crowd because there's still people in your terminal room. One of the most striking sights for me at our last week of Mac OS X conference, Apple brought in the most beautiful equipment. I look at this stuff and you lust after it. You know, it's these wonderful displays. And there was nobody in the terminal room because everybody at the conference had a laptop. I mean, it was just, you know, it was going, it was a showcase, but it wasn't a terminal room. You know, and you guys have been to conferences for years. You know, we're a terminal room, you know, waiting lines and... And you think about that. And there were just other wonderful little, you know, stories, you know, where you see the shape of that future of wireless. At another one of our conferences, one of the guys actually started using Etherpeg to sort of watch the JPEGs that were flying around from people web surfing, right? And this is really amazing. So he wrote the article about it, and then everybody's watching it, and you can kind of see who's paying attention, who's surfing. You know, you don't actually look at any particular thing, but you get this montage of, you know, and is it related to the talk, or is it just random stuff? And then, of course, somebody spammed the thing by writing a little bot to sort of just go look at their own web page, so all it was pictures of this person. But people are playing in this sort of, you know, hacker environment. But we're having to start thinking about what are the implications of wireless when everything is wireless, and when, you know, by the way, Microsoft is starting to really think hard about that. Apple is thinking hard about it. And we need to think about it, too, in the open source community. But I'm going to keep moving here. Okay, another thing that's very much on my radar is web services. You know, periodically we'll get people saying, oh, web services are overhyped. I think they're underhyped. Part of it is web services became identified with a fairly limited set of technology solutions. And I'm sitting way in the cheap seats, and I'm just trying to look at the patterns, you know. And I'm not, you know, necessarily saying that the particular incarnation of the SOAP stack is the future. But what I am saying is the future is once everybody is connected, there's all this great data out there, and hackers are showing me that they want to use it. And they are going to use it. And I know that behind them are going to come entrepreneurs who are going to say, OK, we're going to build companies on this, and eventually we're going to have a platform. So I'll just give you a couple of examples from our own experience at O'Reilly. We have a custom interface to Amazon that we call AmaBooks. It's a market research interface. So we have a guy who spiders Amazon every 3 hours, downloads information about every computer book in their database, just looking for changes in rank, new books, you know, price changes, new reviews, things like that. And he puts it all in a MySQL database. We've got, you know, some 20 million records at this point. He's been doing it for several years. And then we can ask ourselves questions like, what's been the average rank trend of Java books versus Perl books versus Apache books, whatever. We can ask ourselves, what's the average price of an O'Reilly book versus an Addison Wesley book? So we basically built a custom interface because there's all this great data there. Another one of our guys started building an application for carpooling. You know, he basically would look up, people would say, I want to find a carpool mate, and it would take the names out of our company roster, and then it would just go feed them to MapQuest and do some processing and come back and say, well, these people are on the same route with you. So, you know, if hackers are doing it, I know that it's the future. So ultimately, we see that web-facing databases are software components. So, you know, I'm already starting to see the signs that the entrepreneur level is happening, i.e. we're getting beyond the hackers. So if you're on Mac OS X, you guys have probably seen Watson and Sherlock 3, where they're building basically new types of clients that use various types of web services backends. Now, some of those web services backends are done with SOAP, some of them are done with screen scraping, you know, some of them are done with sort of little custom you know, deals between the application developer and the database provider, but it's pretty clear that it's happening. And similarly, you know, you guys obviously know that Google and Amazon have announced web services APIs, and I think this is really going to continue to expand as more sites get into the action. So also very related, not clearly in the same frame as web services, but from the point of view that I'm talking about with thinking paradigm shift and thinking implications, they are very much in the same frame. And that is the fact that you know, Apple's sort of talking about this digital hub strategy, and I guess at this point Microsoft is too. But when you think about iTunes, their music, you know, their music playing software, talking to various devices in your home. You know, so you know, your stereo, your speakers, your eventually your television, all these things connected using software that they call Rendezvous, which is a really neat package. You should look at that if you haven't, which just sort of does random discovery. And I guess actually, those of you with Apple equipment in here, you guys know if you open iChat, you'll find all the other Apple users in the room, because iChat has a Rendezvous feature. It just finds them there. You know, no buddy list. You'll just see the other people who are here in this room if they're also running it. That's the future. You know, we're going to be seeing devices. We're going to be seeing services. We're going to be seeing you know, people. And we have to think about how we're going to develop software that works in that world. And that was kind of interesting. Apple did a Unix Guru Summit recently where they invited in a bunch of big-name Unix people to sort of show off some of their technology and get reactions. And it was kind of interesting. Paul Vixie, the guy who maintains Bind, was particularly vehement about iTunes and Apple not sort of thinking through the implications of their own strategy. Now, I don't know, for those Apple people here in the audience, you know, maybe you guys are all ahead of us with the next version of iTunes, but he's kind of going, why do we have this you know, this server with an interface that doesn't assume that there's going to be other copies of the app? You know, I might have you know, another music database on my server at home. My wife's computer might have one, and yet you're showing me this one, you know, tree of my music. You're not thinking through, you know, your own system and your own, you know, the implications. So that's again part of what I'm trying to drive as an example, just to think about that there are often hidden implications in some of these changes. And after the fact, somebody will make a breakthrough and we'll all go, oh man, that was so obvious. You know, like the Napster idea. You know, after you get that, you go, wow, okay, that is the way people are going to do file sharing. You know, it's not necessarily going to be on the web paradigm. So what are some of the key elements of this paradigm shift that I see in process right now? Well, one piece is obviously the enormous impact of open source. It's commoditizing operating systems and traditional office applications in much the same way that hardware components were commoditized in the PC era. But there are some interesting lessons from the PC era if you go back and look at it. Commoditization was never complete. You know, and if you look at the internet, it's kind of interesting. A huge amount of the internet infrastructure is commodity-based. You know, this Linux or FreeBSD servers, this free software, you know, all through the infrastructure, Bind in particular, but Apache, SendMail, Perl, Python, PHP, you know, all this stuff is pretty fundamental to how the internet works. But also, there's Cisco, right? And people forget that, you know, and Cisco is kind of occupying the Intel position, if you like, in the internet era. You know, they figured out this little proprietary component that sort of sits in the middle of all these commodity components. And so there's that kind of opportunity. Another implication in terms of open source and commoditization are business models. I think people really struggle with, well, what's the business model for open source? But they're trapped in thinking about software as it was in the PC era. And in fact, there are people who are doing a grand job of making money off of open source. You know, Google, Yahoo. Again, I'm not saying in the downturn, everybody's struggling a little bit now. But what about ISPs? Here's this multi-billion-dollar industry that sells, you know, for a monthly fee, access to free software. And of course, because the free software community doesn't think about that as a software business, you know, they're kind of just taken off the ledger. It's a little bit like there's a guy named Steve Bayer, who is an environmentalist, who wrote something, a paper once called The Clothesline Paradox. This was an article about solar energy. He says somebody takes their clothes off the line and puts them in the dryer, you know, the usage of electrical energy goes up, and it gets recorded that, you know, we use more fossil fuels or whatever. But somebody decides not to use their dryer and hangs their stuff on the clothesline, it just vanishes from the balance sheet, so to speak, because nobody says, oh yeah, we increased our use of solar energy for our energy needs. And I think in a similar way, there are a lot of things that are sort of off the radar of people who are involved in the software business, because we don't think of these you know, people as software businesses. So again, you know, people say, well, you know, you'll often hear an attack on free software and open source. It says, where are the applications? You know, the open source community doesn't know how to make applications. You know, and it's maybe true that the open source community doesn't, but fact is, the applications that are built on top of open source, I'll give you a couple. Yahoo, Amazon, Google, right? Those are killer apps of the internet era. Everybody uses them. And yet, because they're out of a different frame, out of this future frame, people don't think of them and think about those implications. So, you know, I think we have to understand that applications are different. And different applications mean that you have to think differently about things like licensing. You know, I told this to Richard Stallman 3 or 4 years ago. I said, you know, you're totally missing the point. The GPL is triggered by software distribution. But most of the really interesting software is no longer distributed. It's simply put up on a server and run. Now, he's thinking about it now, but it took 2 or 3 years, and we still haven't really figured that one out. So we have to ask, you know, in our reframe. But there's another implication, and this relates very much to the competitive situation. And you know, two applications that have done very well for themselves are MapQuest, which how many people here use MapQuest? Right? In the old days, you know, that level of usage, you'd say that's a killer application, right? Everybody uses it, right? AOL Instant Messenger, largest install base of Instant Messenger. But I think they're both doomed. They're both going to be gone within a few years. Why? Because Microsoft thinks platform and other people think application. Microsoft has clearly identified this future internet. Effectively, they're trying to build an internet operating system. It was a great comment that came up once during the Netscape-Microsoft battles. Mark Andreessen said, oh, Windows, it's just a bag of drivers. And, you know, he was absolutely right. And that was the genius of Microsoft. They actually made a Faustian bargain with the industry. You know, they said to people, you know what, this whole, you know, it's a real pain in the neck to keep up with all this hardware. You know, there's so much of it. Tell you what, you just write to our high-level APIs, and we'll take care of that problem for you. You know, we'll give you the bag of drivers. And, you know, most people took that bargain. And that's why Microsoft software is so widespread. And the fact is that what we're dealing with right now is we're trying to build a situation in which we're trying to say, how do we, you know, interface with this website, with that website, with the other website, you know, and people are doing all this screen scraping and hacking and custom services, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that, where people are going to be figuring out how do you connect with remote services, and we're going to have somebody come along and offer us the bag of drivers for the internet. You know, they're going to say, okay, you know, this is a real pain in the ass. Let's just, you know, write to our set of APIs, and God, it'll just work, right? And I think that will eventually happen. But there's a cautionary note. I was talking with Jim Altchin, Microsoft's VP in charge of Windows and .NET, and he kind of said this sort of thing that was very chilling to me. You know, he says, it's just like GUI. Nobody owns it. And I thought, what did he mean? You know, it's just like GUI. Nobody owns it. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, you're saying, okay, when we had that shift from, you know, character-based applications to the graphical user interfaces, it meant there were a whole set of new rules. And Microsoft went and they figured out how to take control. And we're in exactly that same position now, where we're moving into a new era with new sets of rules, and Microsoft is thinking really hard about how they're going to take control. And the way that they're going to do it, and the way that they are doing it, and I've been seeing it sort of unfold pretty much exactly as I thought, I'm getting my 4-minute warning here, is that they're going to offer platform choices. You know, where it's taking instant messaging as an example. AOL is out there saying, okay, we've got dominant market share, we're going to keep it. You know, we're not going to interoperate with other people. Well, how is Microsoft going to attack them? They're going to say, well, you know, there's a lot of cool features in instant messaging. They really ought to be part of the platform. You know, hey, you can use BuddyList and other things besides an IM client, right? So they're going to go around and they will, I think, I'm quite confident that they will eventually own the instant messaging space, unless, of course, something comes out of the open source community to do that. So we have to think, for example, in our own world about instant messaging as platform functionality. How do we figure out what are the services that people will want? How do we, you know, think about, you know, things like buddy lists and other implications of IM and say, okay, that belongs in some other apps as well. So we've got a lot of cool things happening in the open source community. We just have to sort of pull our thinking together. There's a guy, for example, the guy who wrote our book on Jabber, who wrote applications to control an SAP system from his cell phone using Jabber as transport. That's pretty cool. That's the hacker level, though, and we have to get beyond that. I keep moving here. Anyway, so the point is that we are building an internet operating system. And the challenge that faces us is to think about what kind of operating system we want it to be. Now, the Microsoft vision is one in which they figured out how to control it, and they have various kinds of centralized services. You know, they figured out, oh yeah, passport, identity, that's a good control point. Let's go out and own that. Location services, that's a good control point. Let's go out and own that. For that matter, they told me recently that they consider Google a key competitor. They want to own search. You know, so they're thinking about all these pieces and saying, okay, we got to have that one, we got to have that one, we got to have that one. And the alternative, though, is the Unix and Internet model and the Apache model. And that is the model in which the pieces that are loosely joined work using the same set of common protocols. Anybody can play. And it's really an end-to-end system that's not controlled from the center. Now, I'm going to run out of time, but just to give you a couple of pointers. There's a wonderful book, one of my favorite books about Unix. Unfortunately, I didn't publish it. It's Kernahan and Pike's Unix Programming Environment, where they talk about the fundamental principles in the way that Unix programs are expected to interoperate. Similarly, on the internet, we have John Postel's wonderful robustness principle, which was in the original in the TCP RFC. You know, be conservative in what you send out, be liberal in what you accept from others. And of course we see, you know, in the evil times of battling over browsers, where Netscape and Microsoft were exactly reversing that. They were saying, okay, we don't recognize your stuff, but we're going to send out whatever we want, right? So that's a book you should read. This is another book, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, Larry Lessig. He talks about the way that architecture is politics. The architecture of open source and the internet is probably more important than the licenses. We spend a lot of time fretting over licenses, when what we should be fretting over are how do we build systems that work together. Interoperability is what it's all about. And in this regard, and I really will go in just a minute, Ken, there's a really interesting lesson, that I think Apache needs to really pat itself on the back about. And that is that in the standards adherence, it has been such a wonderful weapon for Apache. You know, we look at the history of Netscape. They went and said, we're going to play the Microsoft game. We're going to own various kinds of control points. We have this great platform in the browser. you know, Microsoft said, you know, we know how to play that game, and you know, Netscape is now history, more or less. But Apache said, no, we're going to stay standards compliant. We're going to play according to the internet rules, and of course, Apache has managed to hold its market share quite well. The other great lesson from Apache, I think, is the idea of keeping things relatively small and modular. I remember there was a time when people were saying, God, Apache just hasn't progressed. They haven't added more features, you know? And it was like, yeah, that's right, you know? because the fundamental idea of open source software is that you've got to keep the pieces relatively small. And you want to have another layer? Sure, go add it on. And we'll make sure that they connect to each other. But that allows you to plug and play. You know, somebody can say, okay, I don't like that piece. I'll take it out and put a different one in. So there's a fundamental architecture to Unix and the internet that makes it possible for you to plug in different pieces. Oh, you don't like Perl? Hey, try PHP. You know, try Python. Doesn't matter. You know, whereas in Microsoft's world, those choices are often made for you. It was a really interesting comment that Linus made in when we were working on the book Open Sources. Working on his essay, and it was that he said, "I couldn't have done Linux, you know, in a Microsoft architecture. It's not just about the licenses. It's really about the fact that, you know, the kernel is separable from so much of the other stuff. You know, Microsoft has this big, system in which everything is stuck together, and it's very hard to tease apart, even for them. So, you know, similarly, if you look at successful open source projects like Perl, you know, it's the fact that there's a clear boundary, and you say, okay, here's the core, and now go forward, be fruitful, and multiply. And so CPAN allows anybody to play. The other thing that's really important, I think, from the Unix culture is the idea of documenting as you go. So, you know, man pages are really important. I sometimes say to people that I would take Windows with a man page for every, you know, DLL and a little component over, you know, Windows with a, you know, an open source license. Because, hey, you know, one of the things that Microsoft has figured out is it doesn't really matter if it's open if you make it so complicated that nobody can figure it out. You know, we actually had a meeting, Web Services Summit, in which a Microsoft engineer effectively admitted, you know, that their strategy for dealing with XML's openness was to make all these things so complicated that only tools would read and write them, and they would control the tools. You know, and it's kind of, you know, it's just, you know, fact is, it's architecture that you have to really think about. So I want, you know, you guys, I think Apache, more than any other open source project, is at the forefront of this world. I mean, when people ask me what is the most important open source project, I'll say Apache, hands down. It is the heart of the next generation internet operating system. You know, there's a lot of choices for all of the other pieces, but for, you know, the stack sort of converges, you know, and narrows around Apache. It's where the battles are going to be lost and won. And so I think for you guys, you have to really think, though, further out about where we're going. And I think we really are moving towards a world of truly ubiquitous connectivity. And there are different, there are real consequences for how we have to think about the design of software, the way that interoperability is going to change, the way that servers are going to relate to each other, the technologies that matter, where we have to come up with common standards. You know, one of the beauties of the web was something very simple. It was the fact that you could, for example, go www.foo.com and, you know, find foo. You know, that was a simple convention, a naming convention. You know, so sometimes it's as little as that. Okay. Anyway, you guys, I know you think network, I know you think open, I know you're already thinking about all those things, but do think platform and think about the ways that platform needs to be extended. Thank you.